let's try to study something that we haven't looked at before. Maybe a bit more, perhaps difficult than usual, but let's try to think through it. We've been reading now about the birth of Yaakov and Esav, Jacob and Esau, the forerunners of the Jewish people and the Western world that we find us. We found ourselves in their context. We are in the phase of historical interaction with a culture that is Western culture. That's where the Jews are. The Far East is not our, it's not our problem. It's not our nemesis. It's not Eastern, Far Eastern culture is not a, not at war with us culturally. There's a whole reason for that. But we find ourselves in a Western culture. That is Esav. That is the world around us. Christianity is its ideology, reality or nominally. And we need to understand how to interact with that world. That is the, that's our issue, right? It's only when we deal with that correctly that we'll exit the exile in which they hold us and bring about the final correction of world history. Now, the Gemara says that the Mashiach is sitting at the gates of Rome, right? Sits at the gates of Rome. Actually, another source says that the Mashiach, the Messiah, is sitting at the gates of Gan Eden, which is, let's call it some aspect of the next world. How can he be sitting at both gates? No? How can he be sitting at both gates at the same time? Is that a contradiction? That's right. It could be that where the one gate ends, the other one begins. In other words, where the one ends, the other one begins. When Rome ends, where Rome ends, where the culture that we call Edom, Rome, where that ends, Gan Eden begins, right? He's sitting at the junction, the interface between the two. And it's only when that comes to an end that his dominion can really begin. Where do you see that in Chumash? What image comes to mind that suggests that very strongly? Where do you see that we begin where they end? No. When Yaakov is born, he's holding Esav's heel. That's what you meant, right? When Yaakov is born, he's born holding Esav's heel. Where he ends, where Esav ends, Yaakov begins, right? That's why he's called Yaakov, the one who follows on the heels. So we need to understand that interaction. And the Parsha says that the two children, when they were in Rivka's womb, they were struggling with each other. By Yisroetzer to Abanim, they were struggling with each other. And she didn't understand what this pain in her pregnancy was, and she went to ask for prophetic insight. And she was told, it says, Vayom Hashem Lav, Hashem gave her a prophecy, Shnei Goyim Bevitnech, you have two nations in your womb. And the Chazal say, Shnei Geim Bevitnech, two proud ones, two elevated ones, right? Which means that the leaders of two cultures, two empires, and actually there will be, there's a premonition here of two great figures, Rabbi and Antoninus. Rabbi, the great author of the Mishnah, editor of the Mishnah, and Antoninus, the great Roman emperor, who were very close friends, each one raised to a perfection in his own world. It was a foretaste of the correct relationship, as it should be, between Yaakov and Esau. So you have these two, the root of these two cultures are locked in battle from the womb. Right? Each one is trying to express itself in its own way. Esau is trying to express himself in terms of the appeal that the material world has to him, and Yaakov wishes to express himself in the spiritual world, that option, that path, and the two are struggling. That's a cosmic struggle between the two of them. So let's ask a few questions and see if it leads us to some insight into the world around us and what should be our response to the culture that we live in. I mean, one of the obvious questions here is that it says that they were struggling, these two children in the womb were struggling, Yaakov, the forerunner of the Jewish people, Esav, the forerunner of the Western Empire. And they were struggling about fighting over the inheritance. So it says, they were battling with each other. You know, when two opposite forces are contained in a very tiny space, right, the battle is terrible. And Rashi says on this that our sages have said that the meaning of the battle is that when Rivka walked past the place of Torah, then Yaakov tried to come out at Shemon Eva's yeshiva. He wanted to express himself, as it were, be born. And when they walked past the place of idolatry, then Esav expressed himself, wished to be born, and it means that they are, and Rashi says, Mitzresizim Zemzeh, battling with each other, Mirivim Benachla Shnei Olamos. They are battling over two worlds. In other words, the battle is this world and the next. The battleground is, there's a battle over the definition of reality and where the main, where reality is centered. Is it this world or the next? Is it the world of the material or is it the world of spirit? An obvious question that presents itself here is if two people are arguing about two things, right? Again, if two people are battling over two separate things, the one wants one and the one wants the other, surely you have no battle. Blank faces. You have 2 10-year-old children in a home, right? Two brothers. And they both like vanilla ice cream. Mother serves vanilla ice cream, there's only one helping, there's a battle. But if the mother's serving vanilla ice cream and chocolate ice cream, and the one is addicted to chocolate and one's addicted to vinegar, what battle do you have? Not vinegar. Vanilla. It's a real abnormal child. Vanilla, right? If one of them likes one flavor and one likes another, and you serve two, you don't have a battle, you have a wonderful agreement. Is the question clear? Why were they battling if one wanted this world and one wanted the next world? If Esav is addicted, his essence is expressed in this world, and Yaakov is expressed in Torah and spirituality and lifting himself above this world. One wants mastery of this world, then this is his home. And the other one wants mastery and to be at home in a higher world. What's the battle? Do we see the problem? Nothing would be more amicable. They would each agree, you take yours, I take mine. Let's try again. If two people are arguing about two things, one wants one and one wants the other, why are they arguing? Obviously what's going on here is that there's not an argument here that I want A and you want B. They both want both. The battle here is who'll define reality, which one will be subservient to the other. You look very carefully, you see Rashi's language is that they are battling about both worlds. He doesn't say one wants one wants the other. Merivi benachla shnei olamos. They are battling about the inheritance of two worlds. The battle here is who will define reality. Will this world be subservient to the next, and it's a pathway to get there? It's a vehicle. It must be used for that. Or is the next world only the world of the spirit that serves this world? What do you? Which serves which? Does your mind serve your body? That means you use your mind only to think about how you can give your body more pleasure? Or do you use your body to serve your mind? It's a vehicle to get you where you need to get. Not because you need a body. That's the battle. And therefore, there's a cosmic battle here. That's one question. Let's take another. Listen carefully to what the words are as the parasha begins. It says, Ele toldos Yitzchak, and these are the generations, the children of Yitzchak, of Isaac, ben Avram, son of Avram. Avram, Ele des Yitzchak. Abraham gave birth to Isaac. Very strange. It says, these are the generations, the children, the offspring of Yitzchak, son of Avram. Avram was Yitzchak's father. He's saying the same thing in two. Yeah, you're repeating the same information. He was a son of his father, and his father fathered him. Why do you have to say that? Why do you have to say that these are the children, Yaakov and Esav, who are born from Yitzchak, son of Avram? Then you have to point out that Avram was the father of Yitzchak. So Rashi deals with this question, and he says one idea, and then he says alternative ideas like this. Because it says, the Torah has to say that Yitzchak was the son of Avram, then it has to go on and say that Avram was the father of Yitzchak. Listen carefully to what he says. Lefisha yi leitzanei ador oimrim, because the mockers of that generation, leitzan is a clown or a mocker, me Avimelech nisabra seira, that Sarah became pregnant from Avimelech. That when Avram and Sarah were, when they traveled into Avimelech's territory, he captured Sarah, and he kept her, until Avram was able to release her. And people said that she became pregnant from him. And therefore, the father of Yitzchak was really not Avram. When Sarah had a son, Isaac, his father was really not Abraham. His father was really Avimelech. Why? Sharei kama shanim sha'asa im Avram. Because many years she lived with Avram, she never had a child. Ve'lo nisa Abraham, she never became pregnant by him. They were married for many years. It's well known. In fact, she was 90, and he was 100, when she finally became pregnant. So people said if she lived with him for so many years, and she never became pregnant, and then she's captured by this Abimelech, and suddenly she has a child, it must be that she was pregnant by him, and he's the father of the child. Ma'asa Kodesh Baruch Hu, what did Hashem do? Tsar klaste ponam shel Yitzhak. He caused the face of Yitzhak to look Domel Avram, exactly like Avram's face. He did a call, and everybody could testify of Avram. Everyone who testified that Avram was the father of Yitzhak. And that's why it says Yitzhak was the son of Avram. And then it has to repeat it and say, and Avram was his father, so you shouldn't be victim to the claim of these mockers who said that Sarah was, in fact, had become pregnant not from her husband Avram, but from the man who had taken her, seized her temporarily, and although the Torah tells us that he didn't touch her, but people mocked and they said that he must have been the father. And it's very strange. There are many questions on this. Let's think through some of them. Question one. This parasha is telling us about the birth of Yaakov and Esav. Again, let's get this clear. There are three generations. There's Avram and Sarah, there's Yitzchak and Rivka, and now we're dealing with Yaakov and Esav, born to Rivka. Right? So now when the Torah tells us that Yaakov and Esav are about to be born, now it finds it appropriate to tell us that in the previous generation, Avram was the father of Yitzchak. This is certainly not the place to do it. Again, in case the picture's not clear. You've got the first generation, Avram and Sarah. Then you have Yitzchak born. Here the problem arises. Who was Yitzchak's father? Was it Avram, or was he in fact, was the father of Yitzchak, was it in fact Avimelech when Sarah was taken? So here we see nothing about it. Then the Torah moves to the third generation, when Yitzchak gives birth, has the children, Yaakov and Esav, and here, for some reason, we jump back one generation and point out that Avram was the father of Yitzchak. It's completely out of place. Did I make that clear? Yes? No? Can you see it? You've got stages 1, 2, and 3. We're now dealing with the birth of stage 3. And here, when we deal with the stage of 2 giving birth to 3, we suddenly jump back and point out that 2 was the son of 1. This is not the place to do it. But why is here the big fuss being made about the fact that when we're talking about Yaakov and Esav, we need to establish who was the father of Yitzchak? Right? That's a problem, a big problem. Second question to ask is, why is the mockers of the generation? Mockery means... Mockery always means belittling something important, something dignified, something honored. That's what mocking is. If you examine it, you'll see that mockery, to make something lalag vakeles, that means to make it, to bring it down, to mock a thing, to belittle something, is always the belittling of something that is important and elevated, either genuinely or something that's artificially elevated. You can mock somebody who is, you can cruelly mock somebody who is really elevated and dignified. Or you can maliciously and perhaps even sometimes deservedly mock someone who's pretending to be honored. You can expose him. But mockery always is a bringing down of something that is in one way or another elevated. Where's the mockery here? The appropriate term here should have been that the deniers of the generation, I would have said the right term here in Hebrew would be to say kofrei hador. I would say that those who denied that Sarah could have become pregnant from Avram, who didn't accept the notion of that miracle, wanted to deny the miracle, they said that the husband, in fact, the real father of Yitzchak must have been Yitzchak. Why do you call them mockers? What's the mockery here? What's the clowning around here? What mockery is being expressed here? And furthermore, it's a very peculiar mockery. What are they saying? They're saying that Sarah couldn't have been pregnant by Avram, because for many years she lived with him and she never became pregnant. So when she was taken for a short period by Avimelech, she became pregnant and must have been him. But you know, the real miracle was that Sarah became pregnant. What are these people saying? Abraham was unable to father a child. He was unable to. Many years he lived with her and he was unable to father a child. Or he was too old, he couldn't father a child. Right? He was infertile. He could not be a father. Therefore, when she lives with another man, she becomes pregnant. It must have been him. But that's completely inappropriate. First of all, he had children already. Avram had children. He had children already. He proved that he could be a father. She was the problem. Sarah was the problem. She'd never had a child. The Gemara says she couldn't have a child. She had no womb. Not the Torah says, Ein la vlad. The Gemara says, Ein la bet vlad. She had no womb. She could not. The Gemara even says she was what's called an eilanis. An eilanis is a woman who has no, doesn't develop the features of womanhood when she becomes mature. She couldn't have a child. So the miracle here was really that she became pregnant. How do you get out of that by saying, well, it must have been him, his problem? Is the question clear? You go back two generations and you say that Avraham Avinu could not have been the father, right? Because that would be miraculous. But that doesn't help. Sarah was the one where the miracle occurred. How did you solve that problem? Whether she becomes pregnant from Avram or she becomes pregnant from Avimelech, you're not getting away with explaining away a miracle. The real miracle is her. Whoever the husband is, that's the real miracle. So what are they hoping to achieve? Are the questions clear? Yes? No? Doubtful. Not going to enjoy the answer unless you understand the question. So let's summarize. Question one, why are we jumping back a generation and discussing the lineage and who's the father of Yitzchak when the Torah opens up a discussion about Yaakov and Esav? That's question one. Question two, what mockery is going on here? Right? You're talking about denial of a miracle. Question three, why is the attack against Avram as the father? Surely the real miracle to deny here is Sarah. She's the one who can't have a child. Those are some of the questions. But there's something much deeper going on here. Let's see if we can try to understand what it is. Very deep idea, fundamental idea, not easy. But let's try to follow it through. You know that in Torah, every element in Torah is always a symbol for something deeper. It isn't only a symbol, it's real in itself, of course, but it also is a reflection of something deeper. The basic teaching of the spiritual idea is that this world is a reflection of a deeper world. There's always a deeper reality moving behind the scenes. And on the contrary, the deeper reality is the real one. The one you see is only a reflection of the deeper one. There are always two paths moving in parallel, or as the Kabbalists would say, they're lights and vessels. You see the vessel, but the vessel is lit up by the light inside. The vessel is more tangible, it's easier to get hold of, but it's less real. Take a human being, for example. A person has two levels. There's the vessel, that's the body, the meat. And inside is a light, that's called the soul, the neshama. Personality, the soul, whatever you want to call it, and a person's alive. There's a light that shines inside. You see very clearly when a person dies, it leaves. It's not tangible, you can't get a hold of it. You can only see it through the vessel. You can only see that person's alive and get to know the inner being, their soul, their personality, through the movements of the vessel, of the body. But this doesn't mislead you into thinking that the body's the real aspect. The body's only a vessel, a vehicle. It's a screen on which the image is projected. When you have a friend, a dear friend, someone you love deeply, the essence of your friend is who they are, not their body. Their body's necessary. You can't have a friend without a body. Can't draw a friend to you and embrace them unless they have a body to embrace. But it's not the body you're looking for. Unless you're very, very misguided. Very misguided. The body's essential, but it's a vessel. What you love is the person inside, surely. The body's problematic. It's a problematic vessel. It's given to disintegration. If you leave it to its own devices, it's smelly. Contains excrement. I don't mean to, you know, upset you, but that's where you live. The body's given to all sorts of unpleasant leakages and other problems. But it is the vessel that reflects the inner light. And of course the inner aspect is the more important. But it needs a vessel as well to carry it. So the world always has these two levels. All aspects of Torah are always a vessel for something deeper. Always. Whatever story you're reading in Torah, there's always a deeper story. Chumash says that when Yitzchak was sacrificed, so he survived. The Zohar says he was killed. On one plane he survived. Another plane he became transcended into another world. Paradoxical, but that's what happened. Every human being is a vessel manifest in this world who is carrying something deeper. All the great personalities of Torah are not only people. They also represent a cosmic energy. Abraham, Avraham Avinu, represents a quality called chesed, right? He brings that quality to the world. Chesed means, there's no English word they translate it as loving kindness. I don't know what that means. But it means unlimited giving. It means completely unconditional, unlimited giving. Chesed means completely beyond any rules, any limitation. The Torah uses the word chesed, for example, to mean sexual immorality. Because it's an unlimited giving. That's what immorality is. It's giving every place. Morality means giving fully in the correct place, loyally, and limited to that place, and not elsewhere. Chesed means you give every place. That's the downside. The good side of chesed is the giving, the kindness, the pouring out of. That's called kindness. Avraham Avinu is the... He brings to the world. He's the Amud HaChesed. That means he's the pillar of chesed. When he's born, he brings to the world. He manifests this quality. And it's the original quality. The world is built on chesed. Olam chesed yibaneh. The world is built on chesed. Hashem created the world to show his goodness. That is a manifestation of his goodness. That's what he brings to the world. Not just that he happened to be a kind man. It's much more than that. In the cosmic system, rooted in him is this quality of kindness. And the next quality is called Din. Yitzchak, then his son, is called Din. Din means limitation. The Hebrew word Din is based on the root Dai, which means enough. Right? To be limited. The meaning of this relationship is that first you need kindness and then you need limitation. In every relationship, in everything you do in the world, you need to be a moral person, you need kindness. That means to give of yourself intimately, deeply, what you are, but in a limited way, only at the right time, in the right place. If you don't do that, it's not a kindness, not a positive thing. The world is always built on a giving, which essentially is unlimited, and then a condition in the giving is there must be a limit. When the rain falls, it's a tremendous chesed. When the rain falls, it makes all things grow. In Hebrew, the word geshem doesn't only mean rain, it means all material. All materialism is called Hebrew, is gashmi, geshem. When the rain falls, it's a tremendous kindness. But if it doesn't stop, it's a flood, will destroy everything. It has to stop. A condition in the kindness is that it must stop. Again, stopping is not a value in its own right. To say no, to withhold, to limit, is not a value in its own right. But when it limits the giving, it becomes a condition in the giving. Some people make a mistake, you know, they look at Kabbalistic diagrams, and it shows on the right side kindness, chesed, on the left side din. Make a mistake, they're not balanced. The whole story is chesed. There's only kindness. Hashem only does kindness. The quality of din and limitation and discipline and withholding and darkness is a quality in the giving. Let's take a simple example. Let's say you bring up a child. The parent relates to the child only with love. Only with love. Everything the parent does for the child is love. But to make that love manifest, they have to say no. They have to limit. If you give to a child with no limitation, destroy them. If you feed a child with no limit, you destroy him. If you give a child gifts and right, then you never say no. You destroy the child just as surely as if you give him nothing. And therefore, the reason you say no to a child is not because you want to say no, but because the giving needs a limitation. The rain must stop at the right time to be rain. And therefore, when you discipline a child and you say no or you withhold from a child, it's an act of love. If it's not an act of love, it's a cruelty. The person who says no to a child just because they're withholding, that's completely unacceptable. The no must be a no because the yes is a yes. The no to a child, the discipline, the withholding, acting against the child's wish, is only because you love him. It's as much a giving as the giving. You see this in so many ways. Perhaps one of the most beautiful ways to show it is that in Hebrew, the verb for giving, kindness, means to stop. You know that? The correct verb in Hebrew for chesed is gomel chesed. Gomel chesed. That means to give in an unlimited fashion. The verb is gomel. The trouble is the Hebrew word gomel means to stop giving. Gomel in Hebrew means where the mother weans the child. She stops giving milk. Vayigamal means he was weaned. He no longer needed his mother's milk. So the word gamal in Hebrew, that root in Hebrew, means to stop giving. So the verb we use for giving kindness is to stop giving kindness. But the reason is the time you really give to a person is when you give them independence from you. As long as you make them dependent on you, there's a tremendous humiliation. When a man comes to you every week for a handout, yes, you keep him alive, but you keep him humiliated. But instead of giving him a handout, you give him independence, you give him a way of generating his own income, you make him independent of you, that's a real kindness. When the mother stops giving milk to the child, and the child can live independently, it's a sadness, she's no longer have the pleasure of the connection of giving, but it's a tremendous, that's a much greater act of giving, and when a child grows, of course, it has to tear itself away again. All education of a child is giving the child more and more independence. That's the real giving. And therefore, the quality of din, what the Kabbalists call the left-hand side, the side of limitation, the female side, which gives definition and limited form to the male's unlimited giving. That partnership is exactly what's needed. Those are the two qualities. When Avraham Avinu, when Abraham comes to the world, he brings the quality of chesed to the world. That is what he teaches. His house is completely open. There's no limitation. Anybody can come in. And then he has a son called Yitzchak, which is moving to the left. Yitzchak is the quality of din, completely. You know, you see it again in so many ways. When he was offered on the Mizbeach, on the altar, we call that Akedas Yitzchak, Akedat Yitzchak, right? What does that mean? The binding of Yitzchak. Why is it called the binding? The important aspect is that he was going to be killed. The right way to say that in Hebrew, that he was a sacrifice, he was an oila, he was a... You call it, there are many words to use. The binding? When he was put on the altar, his father tied him, right? The Gemara says he tied his hand to foot and hand to foot. Not that he couldn't move, so that he could kill him. That's only preliminary. That's only a practicality, so that he's not going to flinch. You tie him up. Why, through all of Jewish history, do we refer to that as the binding? And not the slaughtering, the killing, the offering, the sacrificing? The reason is because that's who Yitzchak is, as a binding and a holding in. That's what his quality is. Din means to be constrained. The other word for the left-hand side in Hebrew is called gevura. Gevura, right? Gevura means power. But it doesn't mean the power of beating other people down. It means the power of holding yourself in. The Gemara says, who is a powerful person? A person who rules over his character, has self-control, is more mighty than an army that besieges a city. Milochet ir, a beautiful image that the sages use to describe power, is not like an invading army that breaks down the walls. It's like an army that besieges a city, holds it in. Self-control is holding yourself in. That's real power. Or the Mishnah says, Ezehu Gibor, who's a powerful person, and Moshel B'Yitzro, somebody who controls his instinct, controls his personality, withholding, holding in, constraining, self-control. That's power. That's who Yitzchak is. But here's the problem. When the quality of giving leads to the quality of withholding, the problem is getting the timing right. If you leave it too late, you have a flood. But if you use it too early, you haven't enough rain. When the rain falls and it has to stop, it has to stop at the right time. If it stops too late, everything's been washed away. It's a flood. If it stops too soon, you don't have enough water. And that's the problem. By the way, it's a real practical problem. When you bring up a child, that's the real challenge. Saying yes is no problem. Saying no is no problem. It's getting the balance right. That's it. They contradict each other. They're mutually contradictory. Saying yes to the child and saying no, those are two opposite hands. Not easy to get the balance right. Too much, you spoil the child. Too much withholding is a cruelty. Very hard to get that delicate balance right. And that's called the third point. That's called the center of the body. In the Kabbalistic system, it's in the solar plexus. It's the middle of the body. It's where the two sides are balanced. And that's called Yaakov. That's the third child. Each one is unbalanced on its own. You know, Avraham Avinu comes to the world. He's called the quality of kindness. He has two children. One is called Yishmael, who's a child who uses kindness to the extreme, gets involved in tremendous expression of immorality. And the other child is Yitzchak. That is the child who is a perfect response, as it were. But he has one unbalanced product. Yitzchak also has two children, and one again is unbalanced. He has Yaakov and Esav. Esav is power gone wrong. Yishmael is kindness gone wrong. Esav is power gone wrong, becomes a brutal individual. But there's another child, Yaakov. And Yaakov is the balance point in the center, and therefore he has no imperfect children. He has no extreme coming out of him that's unbalanced. He has 12 sons, and they're all perfect. Because the balance point, you know, in some Eastern sects, they teach that the color of the aura that surrounds a healer is the same as the color of this point. You know, each point in the body, each of these seven mystical points in the body has a color in the aura. I'm going to go into the details now. But the color of this part of the body is the same as the color of an... If you perceive deeper, you look at a person who's a healer, you see that he manifests this position. In fact, in Hebrew, it's very interesting. This part of the body is called Pe'er. Pe'er means a beautiful glow. Right? The Kabbalistic term for this part is called Tiferet. This is called Chesed. This is called Din or Gvura. The middle is called Tiferet. Tiferet means a beautiful, something very beautiful. The reason it's beauty, of course, is because beauty is always a harmony of opposites. Beauty is always where two opposites come together and instead of clashing, they enhance each other. That's why you only have beauty in the higher mode. You can only have beauty in the eyes and ears. In the lower senses of smell, taste, feel, you don't have beauty. You can have pleasure, but you can't have beauty. There's no beautiful smell or beautiful taste. It's a wrong term. It may be pleasurable. It's only in music, in the mode of sound, or in art, in visual mode, that you have beauty. And in both of those modes, the beauty is always opposite things, different things that combine in a way that have a beautiful effect. Much easier to put them together wrong than right, of course. When opposites come together in the Kabbalistic system, when male and female come together, correctly, you have a real beauty. That's why it's called. But the root of the word is Pe'er. Pe'er means something glorious. And if you rearrange the letters of Pe'er, it spells Rofe, a healer. And the reason this place, part of the body, is associated with healing, because a healer can bring into balance unbalanced forces. That's what a healer is. He or she can bring those forces into balance. And therefore, that's the middle, and that's Yaakov. Yaakov is in the mystical system, is in the middle. The right hand is Avram, unlimited chesed. The left hand is Yitzhak, unlimited din. The balance point in the middle is called Yaakov. And he has many names. There are many names. It's called MS, truth, it's called Torah. They are all, each of these representations of the center is always a balance of opposing forces. No time to go into it fully. Just take one example. This is called truth. Truth. Why is the quality of emet, truth, a balance between opposites? Truth is always where two things contradict each other and the solution shows the correctness of both. What is the truth? The truth is always a third element between two conflicting things. For example, when a person makes a statement, if the statement is factual, it's not true, it's just factual. Truth is always something much deeper. If I say to you, for example, the library is open on Wednesdays, and then I say the library is closed on Wednesdays, now we're in trouble. Now here comes the third statement. The library is open in the mornings and closed in the afternoons. The third statement, right, that's called Akosav HaShlishi. The third statement is bringing into balance. Now they all turn out to be true. The misunderstanding before has now been resolved. The third is always a resolution. It's also called Shalom, for example. This is called Shalom. What is Shalom? What is peace? Peace doesn't mean there's no strife. That's not peace. Peace is where warring parties unite in a way that help each other. That's called Shalom. The same Hebrew word as Shalom means Shalem. Shalem means parts coming together. Shalem means parts coming together. You can only have parts coming together when you've got parts that could be separate. Peace on earth doesn't mean that there's no conflict. Peace on earth means that all different factions that could be warring with each other instead help each other. What we call shalom bayit, for example, love and peace between husband and wife. The great thing about that is that these are two opposites coming together. Two complete opposites. You get married, you find that out about 2 hours after you get married, you discover. There are two opposites that come together. And when they come together incorrectly, it's terrible. That could be worse. When they come together correctly, nothing could be better. This is always the meeting of opposites that harmonize and bring out each other's greatness. And their own at the same time. Let's talk about one of those qualities. Again, I know this is difficult, but it's worth a lot of effort. There's one quality of the center that is central to the culture we live in and to what we are supposed to be, and that's called kavod. Kavod means honor. In English, you could call it dignity or honor. The words are all inadequate, but the word kavod. Kavod means a revelation of dignity, which is what the human being is supposed to be. What's different between us and animals? An animal doesn't have... Kavod means... First of all, you know this quality of kavod. The simple one-dimensional translation is dignity or honor. But the deep translation is a revelation of human depth and uniqueness. This organ that we call the liver, in Hebrew is called the kaved. Kabbalistically, that's where kavod is, because always... There are three zones to the human being. There's the brain in the head, origin, thought. There's the chest, where the life-sustaining organs are, the heart and lungs. And then you come down into the world of revelation. What's below the diaphragm are the organs that produce continuity. They take me on through the world, or they produce offspring that are a revelation of something inside coming out. And the liver is, that's why it's called liver in English, because that's where life is vested. Ongoing process that we call life. Kaved and kavod, that's the same thing. Kavod, according to Kabbalistic, according to the deeper understanding, it's kavod is 32, chaf bet is 22, vav dalet is 10. So the deep sources point out 22 letters of the alphabet and the 10 sefirot, the 10 mystical emanations. It's everything. There's nothing else in the world. There are 10 mystical emanations, and if you look at the diagram connecting them, you'll see there are 22 lines that connect them. Each is a different letter of the alphabet that is representing the energy of that interaction. And that's what the world is. There are 32 elements on which the world is built, and they're all in the quality of Kavod. You know, I'm sure you don't need me to tell you. When you read Genesis, you see from the beginning, Bereshis Bara Elokim, the Torah uses the word Elokim, Hashem's name of creation, 32 times. 32 times. Those are the elements of creation. That's why you have 32 teeth. What's situated here? The lev, the heart. Lev is 32. Lamed bet. These are the 32 elements that on which the world is built. And that is called kavod. It means the world is built to reveal who Hashem is in the world. And that's why it says, Olam chesed yibonu, the world is built on kindness. But akol bara lechvod, Hashem created everything to show his kavod, his honor in the world. And the dignity and honor of a human being. Not the animal aspect of a human being. The human aspect of a human being. The angelic aspect of a human being. That is supposed to be a reflection of the divine. And that's why our purpose in life is called kvod shamayim. That means we are in the world to show the glory of Hashem in the world, and we're supposed to be doing it by the glory of what a human being should be. Yaakov is brought to the world to teach this quality of dignity. And the battle between, here's the key, the battle between him and Esav is which is the form that kavod will take. What is the right dignity, glory, honor, revelation of the human content in the world? What form will it take? You know, the problem is that when Adam was created, when man was created originally, he was only a reflection of the divine. When you looked at him, you saw Hashem clearly. This is why he wore no clothes. Again, what's the greatest dishonor? The Gemara says there's nothing more disgusting than a person walking in the street naked. Why? The body's very beautiful. It's divine creation. The answer is, it was once. When man was created originally, he was transparent. The Gemara says he was the size of the universe and he shone many times more brightly than the sun. After he died, sinned and died, the light that shone from his heels was greater than the sun. He was cosmic in his size and he was completely transparent. The Gemara says that when Adam was born, created, made, he was covered in garments of light. He wore what's called kosnos or, garments of light. What does it mean to be clothed in a garment of light? It means to be seen. You looked at the outside, you saw the inside. Why would you need clothing? The Torah says clearly, man and woman were naked, they were not ashamed. Not to be ashamed, because they weren't ashamed. The body, when you looked at the outside, you saw the inside. Why are we ashamed without clothes? The reason we feel shame without clothes is because when you see the outside, you don't see the inside, you see the outside. You look at a person without clothes, you're seeing, you looking at a horse, basically. The reason we feel ashamed without clothes is because when you look at yourself without clothing, you know that inside you're an angelic being, and outside you look like a... upgrade on an orangutan or downgrade. We deal with that by wearing clothing. The Hebrew word for a garment is levush. Levush means loy boish, not to be ashamed. The word says it. Levush means not to be ashamed. The Talmud says your garments are your honor, your dignity. Your body is no longer your dignity. When man was created originally, man and woman, they were naked and there was nothing more glorious. They shone like the sun. When you look, you couldn't even see their bodies. All you saw was their souls. If you want to picture it, it's... when you look at a human being now, all you see is the body. If you look very carefully at somebody who's spiritually elevated, you can see a faint glow on the face. Maybe. But when Adam was created, it was exactly the opposite. When you looked at him, all you saw was his soul. And if you looked very carefully, you could make out the wispy outlines of a body. After he sinned, he crashed the whole thing into complete imbalance. After he became part of the world and he made the world part of him, then he crashed into an animal. And the solution was to wear clothing. You know what man did when he crashed? He covered his nakedness, the most embarrassing part of his nakedness, with a fig leaf. And Hashem arrived in the garden and said, you have to learn a lesson now. Now, from now on, the correction must always be the problem. You must make the problem into the correction. The problem must become the solution. You wear clothes now not only to hide your nakedness, now you must wear clothes to reveal your dignity. And he sewed him garments of or. He was first clothed in garments of or, aleph vavresh, light. And then he was given glorious, dignified garments of ayin vavresh. Ayin vavresh in Hebrew, aleph vavresh, ayin, very similar. The only difference is that the aleph becomes an ayin, it means it becomes physical. The Hebrew word Aleph Vav Resh means light. The Hebrew word Ayin Vav Resh means skin. But if you know a little Hebrew, you know that Ayin Vav Resh spells blind, Iver, blind. Or in Hebrew means to be blind. By the way, that's why it's called a hide in English. Why is this called a hide? Before it was a reveal, man was clothed in light, you saw the inside. Now he's clothed in a skin that doesn't let you see the inside. The solution, our solution is we wear clothing. You wear clothes for two reasons. The clothing hides who you are, but it reveals your honor. When a king wears a royal garment, it hides the king you don't see, but you see he's a king. The lower the part of the body, the more it needs to be covered for humiliation. The higher the part of the body, the more it needs to be covered to show dignity. Why do you wear a hat? What's the meaning of a hat? That is the least necessary. Your shoes are the most necessary. And trousers are highly recommended. A hat's not necessary. The higher you move in the body, the more the function becomes dignity. By the way, that's why the world today pays no attention to this. There was a time when a person wouldn't be seen in the street without a hat, no question about it. It was not long ago, 50 years ago. Especially in this country. A person wouldn't walk in the street without a hat on, feel naked. You couldn't go anywhere decent without... You couldn't go to a restaurant or a hotel without a jacket and tie. It was understood. Today, people go to the opera in their pajamas and somebody's beer advertised across their chest. You can smell their feet, it's even better. But clothing, the function of clothes. And that's the problem. Because a garment demonstrates who you are, but it also betrays you. Because you don't see the person. The Hebrew word for a garment is beged. It's exactly the same word as treachery. In Hebrew, boged is a traitor. So when you wear a garment, you're betraying the outer garment. In Hebrew, a beged is a garment. Means a treachery. An outer garment, a coat, is called a me'il in Hebrew. Me'il means spiritual treachery. Me'ilah in Hebrew means to take something sacred and take it out into the profane. To betray something sacred. Also the same idea. And that was the result of the sin. In order, now there's no going naked. Maybe one day there will be. Maybe. Again. Possibly. Eventually. But now that we've been part of the animal's part of us, now we need to assert our difference from the animal. People don't understand. They walk in the streets, especially women, dressed like they're about to take a bath. But they think they look beautiful that way. Nothing could be more humiliating. There was a time when the body was only spiritual. It's not now. What became of this battle between the beauty of the body, the genuine glow of the spiritual existence of the human being, and the treachery? Those two aspects were inherited by Jacob and Esau, Yaakov and Esau. They inherited that split. Yaakov took the beauty of man. The Gemara says his face was looked like Adam. His face is engraved on the throne, Hashem's throne. The glow on his face goes back to the perfect human form in Gan Eden. And Esau took the clothing. What did Esau take from Adam? You know, Adam had amazing clothes. The clothes that he was sown, which came from Gan Eden. So the Medrash said that Esau inherited those clothes. In fact, you know that when Yaakov pretended to be Esau, he took the clothing from his mother. She was keeping them. He didn't trust his wives. Couldn't trust them. He left his garments, which were these incredible, priceless garments that had come from Adam. The Medrash says that when Yaakov walked in wearing them, Yitzchak smelt Gan Eden. Of course he smelt Gan Eden. That's where the clothing came from. Esav inherited the garments, and Yaakov inherited the essence. And that's the debate, and that's the world we live in today. There's two aspects of glory, dignity. There's who you are and how you present yourself. And that's our battle with the culture around us. Our tradition is to reveal the truth. At Sinai, Hashem said, Atem Eda, you're my witnesses. A witness reveals the truth when it's not apparent. You don't need a witness when you see the event yourself. Witnesses come to testify about something that's not immediately visible. That's our role. We are supposed to be carrying the face of Yaakov. When you look at a Jew who's built himself correctly, you should be seeing something of that original human form. And the culture we live in is a culture that presents an exterior. It's a culture of wrapping and packaging. And there's no question who has the upper hand. Today we live in a culture which is only the external. In fact, today it's impossible to reveal the internal. You can't reveal who you really are. It's just it wouldn't fit into this world. You can't reveal the truth about yourself. You can't reveal truth. It's like I once had a conversation with a taxi driver. The taxi driver told me that he has a project to become a very honest. He wants to be an honest man. He wants to be pure. What's his problem? That when he hands in his tax, he has to tell me how much he earns. He has to declare how much he earns so they can tax him. He said he always has to halve his earnings because they always double whatever he says. He can't tell the truth. He said, but the tax department, whatever you declare, they automatically double because they assume you're lying, and they tax you on double. So if he declares his genuine earnings, they double it. He can't afford the tax. So he has to lie. He has no option of being a truthful man. The world is... They assume that he's lying because everybody does. So whatever he says, they double. So he has to halve it, like everyone else. Otherwise, he wouldn't survive. The world doesn't tolerate. We live in a world where it's an Aesop world. And that's the battle. The battle in the womb was, who represents human dignity? Will it be a dignity of the garments, the externality, how you look and how you present yourself in the world, or will it be who you are? Very hard battle. It's a conflict. The two... Let's take a moment and just scratch beneath the surface. What is this quality of glory, of covet? It's a paradox. When you show someone dignity, whether it's your Rebbe, your Torah teacher, whether it's your parents, a king, a Torah sage, Hashem, the quality of glory, of honor, of honoring someone is always two paradoxical emotions. It's love and fear at the same time. It's the Avram function of love and wanting to be close to, and the Yitzchak function of din and shrinking away from. You have a Rebbe you love, your Torah teacher, a person of tremendous, indescribable greatness. You have two conflicting emotions. One is you long to be close to the tremendous love. On the other hand, you're in such awe, you couldn't come close. How are you supposed to treat a parent? The mitzvah of kibud av va'em has two components. There's two components. The Torah states the mitzvah to honor parents in two opposing ways. There's first the mitzvah of yira, which means you're not allowed to stand in your father's place, you're not allowed to argue with him, you can't say he's wrong, you can't sit in his place, you have to stand up when he walks in, you can't even say he's right because that's condescending. You're not allowed to say your father's right. When your father's arguing with someone else, you're not allowed to walk in and say my father's right. Who are you to judge your father's opinion? You're allowed to say the other guy's wrong, that you can do, but you can't say your father's right. That's yira, that's it. Not allowed to use a parent's first name. You may never use a parent's first name. No, if they're present, but they're not present, they're alive, they're not alive. Can't use a parent's first name. It's not your buddy. And there's another mitzvah to honor love. You have to feed them, your parents. You have to clothe them. You have to give them to drink. You have to put their shoes on. You have to dress them, cover them. You have to take them where they need to go. There's an act of love when they're not capable of doing it themselves. Two opposite things. One is tremendous closeness and love and caring, and the other is tremendous awe and respect and distance. How are you supposed to relate to Hashem? Always paradoxical. When you daven, when you pray, for example, you're supposed to have two conflicting emotions. You should feel such love that you're about to speak to Hashem face to face. And as you realize that you're about to speak to Him face to face, do you have to have such fear and awe? It says, "V'gil ubir odo," you have to rejoice in trembling. Rejoice in trembling. But we are creatures of mixed emotions. We have mixed feelings. Imagine you're about to knock on the door of somebody tremendously powerful. And if he will listen to you and give you time, he could change your life completely. How do you feel as you knock on the door? Amazing opportunity, tremendous rejoicing, but awestruck, fear, terror, who knows what might go wrong here. And therefore the mitzvah of kavod, kavod always means two conflicting responses at the same time. You know, there's a very beautiful illustration of this. When the Rambam talks about this, listen to his words. How are you supposed to honor Hashem? Hakel hanichbad v'anoyra hazeh, this God, who is honored and glorious, awesome. Mitzvah la'ava l'yiroisa. It's a mitzvah to love him and to fear him. Shenema, because it says, v'avta shashem alakecha, you have to love Hashem, v'nema, and also says, es Hashem alakecha tira, you shall fear God. So the Rambam says, when it comes to the mitzvah of honoring Hashem, there are two mitzvahs. There's a mitzvah to love him and a mitzvah to fear him. Then he says, v'he'achi aderech la'avasa v'yirasi. What is the path? How do you get to this loving of Hashem and fearing of Hashem? And then he goes on to tell you how you do it. It's very problematic, these words. This honored and glorious, awesome God. It's a mitzvah to love him and fear him. Why does he put them both together? He doesn't do that anywhere else. The mitzvah of loving Hashem is important enough to be discussed on its own. The mitzvah of fearing Hashem is important enough to be discussed on its own. You have to lump them together. Again, the Rambam doesn't do that. He goes through every mitzvah in the Torah and he discusses it in depth and in detail. He doesn't mix things together. Here in one sentence, the Rambam has combined two completely different mitzvahs. They're two verses in the Torah. They're two completely separate obligations. Why is he putting them together? The answer is, kavod means mixing these two together. The mitzvah of honoring Hashem means to love and fear him at the same time. Now, I'm going to make a mistake. He wasn't saving, ink. Honor of someone you respect, real respect, is love. That means they're worthy of respect. You'd like to be like them and to be close to them. And there's all reverence. And then he says, and what is the pathway? V'he'achi aderech. What is the path? How do you do this mitzvah of loving and fearing Hashem? He doesn't do that elsewhere, the Rambam. He doesn't say, and what is the way you take a lulav? And what is the way you do this mitzvah, that mitzvah? He doesn't do that. Why does he ask it here? Because here he has a problem. How can you love and fear at the same time? This whole chapter in Hilchos Yisrei HaTorah, the Rambam is talking about honoring Hashem. The whole problem he's dealing with here and teaching you is that honoring Hashem means having two conflicting emotions at the same time. And the origin of these two conflicting emotions is the birth of two people called Yaakov and Esav. When these two are born, there are two conflicting issues here. Which is the right, how will this paradox be resolved? Will it come out as an Esav, whose concept of glory is always the way things look? Look at his culture. Look at the culture. You're living in an Esav culture. It doesn't have to look far. Look at the manifestations of their honor, dignity, religion. They're very grand. Tremendous display of uniform and of ceremony, and of whether it's ceremony in time, whether it's... tremendous expense and tremendous detail, very lustrous and beautiful. Our role is to demonstrate real dignity. That's the real inner quality. And there's a tension. Strictly speaking, an inner beauty should have an external beauty to demonstrate. Absolutely. When Adam was created, he was that way. But now, no time to talk about it now, but a woman's beauty. Woman's beauty is also like that. Places in the Torah where the Torah talks about spiritually great people and describes their beauty. Why? Who's interested in a physical beauty? Sarah was so beautiful that the Egyptians were ready to kill for her. Why does the Torah talk about her physical beauty? Who cares about her beauty? A woman's beauty is problematic. It's misleading. It's a great disadvantage for a woman to be too good looking. Very big disadvantage. Very bad for her. When a girl grows up extremely good looking, she gets praised for her looks. The content is... that's the culture. Examine the poetry and the culture. Bring me one pop song that talks about the beauty of the girl's mind. I'll sing it in public. Just one. The whole culture around us is praising the animal. That's the attractiveness. And women are so battered in sensitivity that they appreciate it instead of feeling insulted. The culture looks at a woman, instead of talking about who she is, it talks about her horse meat. No? There was a relationship between the two. External beauty was the correct vehicle and vessel. But now it's problematic. Now it has to be shown in what we call tznius. Tznius means a modesty, a refinement. which is a refinement also. It isn't only the length of a skirt or the length of a sleeve. It's a deportment. Also, it's the way you walk, and it's the way you talk, and the way you smell. So this is also perfume. A woman walks into a room and half of the men fall over anesthetized. That's not sneers. In the original world, the two were meant to go together. There was an external. Clothes weren't necessary. Nothing could have been more beautiful than the external vessel that of perfection that showed a perfect interior. But now you have a war between the two, and the question is, we've been thrust into this culture to overcome it. The reason we've been put into this culture is to bring out inner dignity in a world that makes it almost impossible. And therefore, what we studied this evening was, this battle began a long time ago when Yaakov and Esau were children in the womb, identical in many ways, but each one had a different understanding of what human dignity is, and there have to be two. The whole point about honoring Hashem is that you have free will to take it either way. You know, one other feature, we didn't speak about this, we'll finish with this. In order to honor someone, you must be free to dishonor them. Anyone who's forced to honor someone else, that's a pure disgrace. If I put a gun to your head and make you recite my praises, very humiliating. Only a person who could refuse to give honor who gives. A human being was created with free will. Only by voluntarily giving honor to Hashem is a genuine honor. If we were created as puppets, right? There are countries like that where the dictator insists that everybody honor him. They make statues of him and they paint paintings of him and they say that he's the greatest. What a humiliation. Real honor is given by a person who doesn't have to, but wants to. And therefore the human being is created with two versions of this quality. There's a Yaakov version and an Esau version. And the question, which is the one that will define humanity? And at the moment, we are not winning the battle. There's no question about it. We're absorbed in a culture that teaches only presentation and packaging and externality and clothing. Let's go back to the beginning and we'll finish with that. Why did the mockers of that generation, late Sanei Hador, those who mock, mockery is against honor and dignity. These are not people who denied a miracle. That wasn't the issue. A late is a clown. A clown... Mockery is always taking something of genuine honor and dignity and bringing it down and belittling it. In Musa, it's well known, you can speak for a whole hour and build something elevated, and one ridiculous mocking comment can break the whole thing down. From one perspective, mockery is the worst characteristic. Other bad characteristics, but mockery, person who's a mocker will never... Person who never takes anything seriously, mocks everything, brings it down, no hope for such a person. Never get to any elevation or refinement. The mockers of that generation, they were not deniers. The reason the Torah here, by Yaakov and Esau, when the two of them are born and there's a battle going on between which is the real dignity, how do you solve that problem of the balance between love and awe? We go back a generation when Avram Avinu is the father and Yitzhak's the child. Those two have to go together. The quality of chesed and the quality of din have to mesh in such a way that the one's born from the other. Avram Avinu, the quality of chesed, gives rise to a child, gives birth to a child who's minis adin, which is the quality, the qualification, the condition in the chesed. And that's what they want to sever. The mockers of that generation said he wasn't the father. Someone else was the father. Avimelech was the father. What they're trying to do here is break the connection between the chesed and the din that is real honor. Now when Yaakov and Esau are born, when the cosmic battle of history is about to begin, where will the human being really be expressed? Will it be in your inner spiritual connection to what's real, or will it be in your external packaging and how you look to others, how you present yourself, and how the facade you build for yourself? Here it was essential for them to go back and sever the connection between the two. And here the Torah says they began to mock and they went back and they said, Avram and Yitzhak are not connected. The quality of chesed and the quality of din have nothing to do with each other. Forget Avram, he's not the father. All that matters is the quality of din, the externality, the limitation, how you appear, that's all that matters. And therefore, there's no greater mockery than that. The real human dignity is the Yaakov who reflects the correct balance between the two. That is what genuine beauty is, where somehow you manage to let the inner beauty shine through. When a woman behaves, woman conducts herself with sneers, it doesn't mean she's covered. The simple understanding is she's covered, her skirt is long, her sleeves are long. It doesn't mean that, it means she's revealed. By the dignity and the grace of her bearing and her dress and her conduct, she shows genuine beauty in the world. It's easy to look ugly. That's not the point. The object is not to look ugly. The object is to look spiritually beautiful. Okay, we'll stop there.
Tired,
eh? You're so quiet.
You're tired.
Thank you. Yeah. Shalom, David. Shalom, Lechem.
Shalom.